In today's podcast, we do delve into some sensitive and potentially triggering topics. Viewer discretion is advised, or listener discretion is advised, particularly around children and young people. And if you or anybody you know is suffering with mental health challenges, we strongly encourage you to seek professional support. Welcome to the Working on Wellbeing podcast by the World Wellbeing Movement, the podcast that allows you to be a fly on the wall during conversations with the world's leading wellbeing experts. In today's episode, we'll hear from an entrepreneur turned chief wellbeing officer who has taken an innovative, data-informed approach to improving employee wellbeing, and who is also on a mission to prove through tangible results why the world needs more chief wellbeing officers. But as always, before we dive into today's interview, I would first like to take a moment to thank our series sponsor, S&P Global. The world's leading organizations rely on S&P Global for the essential intelligence they need to make confident decisions. S&P Global, powering global markets. Now, today's guest pivoted her career from being a management consultant to founding a startup and becoming an entrepreneur to becoming Aon's first chief wellbeing officer. She is passionate about leveraging data to uncover the link between wellbeing and performance. And she has created a tool, the Human Sustainability Index, to enable this. She is also passionate about enabling more organizations to hire chief wellbeing officers at that very senior C-suite level. And in that way, she's not pulling the ladder up behind her, but rather she's extending that proverbial ladder to empower other people to follow in her footsteps to become chief wellbeing officers. And she wrote an article about this because she believes in it so passionately. And I thought a really nice way to introduce her would be to read a short extract from that article. So Rachel Fellows, Aon's chief wellbeing officer, says, "Everyone knows and understands the arguments as to why wellbeing needs to be taken seriously. So here's her rallying call and vision. Rachel would like to see more senior people like her at the top table. She says, for real change on the wellbeing agenda, there has to be more of us speaking with CEOs and senior business leaders, helping them understand the ways to move the dial. It's not a side issue anymore. Wellbeing is critical to business success. And if you are leading an organization, you know that healthy, happy, productive people are what makes the difference between success and failure." I thought they were really powerful words, and I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome you, Rachel Fellows, to the Working on Wellbeing podcast.
Thank you, Sarah. Gosh, what a privilege. I was just enjoying, I couldn't believe how well you recited that without even looking at your notes. That was so impressive. But it's an absolute privilege to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, there you go. Your words are like poetry to me because, needless to say, I wholeheartedly agree. But, you know, it's still quite an unusual job title, isn't it? Chief Wellbeing Officer. So we have had another Chief Wellbeing Officer. You're not the first guest, I'm delighted to say, with that job title. And hopefully we will have more. And as you say, it will become more commonplace. But I imagine that when you were a young girl, you probably didn't tell your parents, "When I grow up, I'd like to be a chief wellbeing officer." So I'd love to know how you got there, and were there any defining moments throughout your career, throughout your life, that made you decide to work on wellbeing?
Yeah, and what a gorgeous question. Thank you for starting there, because my mind actually goes to a couple of different moments, images in my history, probably one where I was about 13, 14. And I was quite a sort of normal academic student. I was interested in the idea of working hard. I was conscientious and I wanted to kind of perform in the standard way. But I also had this sort of red herringness about me, which is partly driven by my family. We're a group of artists and we're a group of accountants, that really classic blend. But the artists in my gang were suddenly My 8-year-old grandfather took a degree in Reiki.
Wow.
My granny became fascinated in nutrition. So I was suddenly educated in and outside of the normal conventions about traditional ways of life and very non-traditional ways of life. And that really sparked my interest. And then from there, I started to sort of, rather than asking for a party when I was 21, I was like, can everybody donate to start my education around well-being? So I parallel ran my almost a personal investigation around these two blended philosophies for the first 10 years of my career, really.
Goodness, that's so interesting. And you've moved around quite a bit because you started out as a management consultant. You then founded your own startup before becoming Aon's Chief Wellbeing Officer. And I'm really interested in that blend because I did read somewhere, as somebody who also started out my career many moons ago in consultancy, I recognized some words when you read that you were sick of working long hours and you decided to found your own startup. What brought you back to the corporate world? What brought you back to the world of multinationals? And did you have any hesitation in going back?
Yeah, what a great question. Look, I think there's something in it that many of us want to champion change but don't want to do it at the coalface. And I think what I was observing, I adored my time at my first stage in my career as management consultancy. It was the most phenomenal foundation. But I was also seeking, how do I want to create change in the world?
Yeah.
And for me, it was about well-being. And I mean, look, we're thinking, what, 10, 15 years ago? It was a swear word then. So even going to Bath University and trying to create a business well-being degree, you're sort of begging the business department and the social policy department to create that degree. It was so early. And then I was just super lucky that I started to create a community of advocates. Think of Stella McCartney, think of Schroeder's Asset Management, think of British Rowing. And they were just so curious about this blend. Can you have both? Does it always have to be either or? And then that led me to starting up my own business. And the pandemic was a gift. There are many different layers to that door being opened. But suddenly it was like, actually, the corporate world want to investigate this. They now see the value, the sustainable performance value. And so I didn't feel like it was going back, actually. It felt almost like a maturity of myself. And actually, no, the platform now is bigger. Yeah. The platform was very clearly global as well. So how do you start to make an impact across different cultures, which is fascinating, even 18 months into role now.
Amazing. And, you know, you talk about being a chief wellbeing officer. We've talked about the corporate world. Of course, there's many different types of industries, and we'll have listeners listening who work in many different fields, many different job types. I'm going back to your powerful words from that article, which, by the way, the title of that article is Wellbeing Can't Wait, Why We Need More Chief Wellbeing Officers at the Table. I'd love you, in your own words, to tell me more about why this is so important to you.
I love using contrast to think about things. So maybe we can kind of carry on with that analogy. And there's the contrast of what is the pain or the real risk in the world? And then what's the opportunity? So if you look at the risk, even thinking about, okay, so I start to look at each month with my hat on, and I think about Aon colleagues, we've got 50,000 around 120 different countries. Where am I seeing these pockets of crisis, whether that be mental health or how we're using counselling services? And then you also observe the bigger, which you are so much closer to than I am, but around the policies across different countries. And I was lucky enough to be at a mental health forum in New York about 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And there were statistics there whereby something like 37% of under 27-year-olds in the US are clinically depressed, whether they have anxiety, depression, or an opioid addiction, which is just mind-blowing. So if those are now not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%, these are double digit and they're growing and we're spending money and it's not working. So the risk is a real red flag, not even a flag, but a bulging something that we all can't ignore. And it's, you know, very crudely, it's a cost, yeah, whether you're a government, whether you're an organisation or a mum.
Yeah.
On the other side, though, I don't want to sound too much like David Attenborough, but there is this opportunity of evolution of how do we begin to be far more thoughtful and systemic or systematic in our thinking, that all of this is interconnected. Mm. And what if we start to think about sustainable performance? Because actually, the beauty of the younger generations is they are not allowing us to get away with ignoring it anymore. But those younger generations are now in management positions. This is not early careers anymore. they're now kind of three steps in and they're starting to disrupt and deruffle and challenge the status quo on the top. So I think it's a huge, if we get it right, a huge magnet for a brand like an Aon to attract brilliant people and also have a sustainable impact in a highly volatile world on our performance. But there's also this very real risk and responsibility, as, you know, think about reading the papers in the last couple of months, the doctor strikes, junior doctor strikes continue. Like, we're all in it together, governments, organisations, charities, families. We need to figure out where we choose to pay our attention to this crisis too.
Yeah, I mean, again, really powerful words. And thank you for sharing those statistics, because I think it's really important for all of us to remember that's why we care so much. That's why those of us working in the wellbeing industry want to put wellbeing first. And I think we need to remember that this is why governments, businesses and individuals do need to do more. I'm with you. Business is one good place to start. Public policy is another. And for listeners who are interested in public policy, we've had some really interesting interviews on that with Lord Richard Layard, Lord Gus O'Donnell and Kim Leadbeater, who is an MP. But I want to go back to the workplace, because the reality is, I sound like a stuck record, actually, because I say it nearly every time, but most of us spend over a third of our waking lives at work, those of us of working age. So, of course, it's a huge driver of our well-being. But it's interesting because there's definitely been an increase in investment in well-being by companies across the globe. And there's a lot of indicators that show this. And I've talked publicly before about what I'm calling the work well-being paradox. And I define that quite simply as, despite this increased investment in employee well-being, we are counterintuitively still seeing year-on-year increases in indicators of employee negative stress and unhappiness. And so I talked about this at the World Happiness Summit last year, and I shared a few thoughts that I had as to what might be driving that and what we might need to do to solve it. I don't think anybody has all the answers, but one of the observations I noted was that far too many organisations are basing their employee wellbeing strategies on reactive support. So, i.e. supporting those employees who are actively suffering from mental health challenges, which, according to Gallup, in the general population, about 15% of people are actively suffering at any one point. But equally as worrying, about 58% of people, according to Gallup, are struggling. So they are at risk of tipping over into that suffering space. And I posed the question at that event, shouldn't our corporate wellbeing strategies aim to support all employees, not just those who are worst off? And I want to pose the same question to you, because I've heard you talk about this same challenge, but in different terms, because you've kind of talked about the difference between ill-being and well-being. Can you tell me more about that, and also tell me a bit more about how, in your current role, you're supporting not only ill-being, but also well-being?
Yeah, and I'm really interested in words, and I think they can be very provocative. And part of this is to be provocative.
Yeah.
So whether it be colleagues or clients, and I don't even understand what you're talking about. You're saying ill-being, well-being, and now you're throwing in this something of human sustainability. And I'm like, well, good, because I want you to think harder about the reality of what's going on.
Yeah.
So for me, ill-being, which I also appreciate as I'm learning from colleagues and clients, maybe doesn't resonate in the US. Maybe it's ill care or health care, but it's the same premise. So ill-being is about how we help people in times of need.
Mm-hmm.
And majority of businesses spend 99% of their spend on that. So think about the plaster, the band-aid, you know, reactive to your point. So actually, I often play back, so you don't have a well-being strategy, you have an ill-being strategy. And that's okay. That can be your choice, but as long as it's a conscious choice driven by data. And it's often then a risk strategy, not a cultural transformation strategy, that just makes me wink, because that's probably sounding a bit too management consultancy. But the middle bucket is about that, I wouldn't even say the 57 or 58%, that's about the 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of where you're on the spectrum, how do we educate you to know how to cope, survive, maybe even thrive in this crazy world? And that's where we become a little bit maybe more disciplined around accountability. But what we do start to talk about is Rachel has responsibility to look after herself in a modern world, but we will provide best-in-class support around you to be able to self-regulate. But we then differentiate the role of the manager. So I don't think, so Sarah, say if you're my manager, you're not responsible for my well-being, but you're responsible for creating a reasonable environment for me to thrive in. So actually, our whole focus next year is just on team well-being, team sustainability. That is things like the behaviours you choose to applaud or call out, akin to the anti-racism movement. We need to start to call out burnout behaviours because most of us who are in it can't see it. So we need that lens of a manager. We need to create capacity in managers' roles to be able to realise that the humanness, the well-being, the sustainability is also part of their performance metrics. And then we need to start to layer this up again up to leadership, who I think leaders now own talent sustainability or human sustainability. How do we start to think about structural changes such as pay, incentives, such as, you know, the ways that we're going to actually start to think about designing careers, designing work to enable people and acknowledge the challenge that's going on. So hopefully that helps, but it's ill-being, well-being, human sustainability, and then suddenly at this well-being piece, a clear difference between the role of a manager and a leader than a colleague.
That's super helpful, and there's a lot I want to dig into. But certainly on the ill-being, well-being, I'm hearing that it's really important to have those reactive supports in place to support those who are struggling. And we're not for a second saying it's not important, but it's equally as important to prevent others from falling into that struggling place. So we need to be increasing budgets. We need to be increasing initiatives and supports around that.
Can I just share one thing off the back of that?
Yeah.
Because I hear you, and I can hear people in a recessionary or a cost of living crisis going, it's not realistic. So I think what's really interesting for me is to start to try and understand, I call it like the ROI ceiling. This might have been where your question was going, so sorry. But on the individual, in the nicest possible way, you mentioned like a third of your time is at work. But what sphere of influence does work have on Rachel in terms of what food she decides to eat, how she chooses to recover at the weekend, her relationship with her husband and her three-year-old, nearly four-year-old daughter? Actually, there's always going to be a lower ceiling on an organization's influence on a human being. When you start to take it, interestingly, the research is shifting more in the UK, but when you start to take it to that team space, rather than it being 5 to 10% ROI, it's starting to go 25%. Because actually, if you create the social glue in a team, your influence, your ability to actually get a return on your investment is higher. So I don't want to be provocative and say it's a dollar out of one bucket and into another. But in a way, we might end up having to make those harder decisions.
Yeah, and I think it is a good point because I think you and I have probably both been in positions during our career, because I also sort of come from a corporate background before I moved into this role, where we have been seeking from the CFO extra budget. And the question has been, a CFO is trained to ask, what is the return on investment on that? But there is a lot more research now. And, you know, one of our previous guests was Professor Jan Emanuel Deneve, who is a co-founder of the World Wellbeing Movement. He and his research team have done a lot of work to show the positive impact that improving employee well-being can have on productivity, on financial and stock market performance, on talent attraction and on talent retention. And I know that you've also done some research on that as well. So for any CFOs who are listening, thinking about tightening their purse strings, what's your message to them?
Yeah. And again, you know, I love imagery. I think it's really important. So we often use the classic seesaw. On one side of the seesaw, you have your very traditional and hugely important performance metrics. So think profit and loss, revenue, think personal and individual performance KPIs as well. On the second part of that seesaw, you have what I would frame as a sustainability metric. So think about D&I, inclusion and belonging. Think about ways of working. At Aon, we call those that smart working, the choices we make and the ways that we work. And think about well-being. Yeah. And this is all now part of a performance picture. And what's really interesting is that the one side of the sustainability side of the seesaw is actually more obviously impacting the traditional performance metrics. So at Aon now, we have all of that data in one place and we can start to see, oh, if we invest here, what impact might that have? Initially, we're just at the correlation stage. Really interesting, we can see that in certain areas of our business, what starts to influence higher performance is higher well-being and inclusion. This might sound theoretically yes, but to have that data on ourselves to inform better decisions up at the top, amazing. What we're now working towards next year is if I make a change in with my team, the investments we make around well-being, well, going from the ill-being to the well-being pot by way of example, what impact does that have on our performance and sustainability side of that seesaw? And that's really where I feel when I start to speak to the own exec, thinking through, again, language of sustainable performance is really where we start to catch them. Rather than it sort of grounding down into ill-being, yes, that's a risk. We're a risk, part risk business. We're also a human capital business. But it starts to elevate the conversation into something that's relevant to everybody day to day.
So I want to get your definition. There's a word that you've mentioned a few times, or a phrase. You've mentioned the phrase human sustainability. Tell me more about exactly how you define that. And I believe that the tool that you've created is called the Human Sustainability Index. So I'd love to also hear a little bit about what that is and how that's going to provide helpful insights.
Yeah, I love that. And if you take the kind of classic sort of sustainability definition of, you know, we're actually meeting our longer term gains or our short term gains without compromising either or. Yeah. And the same kind of goes for humanness. So how do we enable our talent to thrive and meet our short term needs, but without compromising their long term quality of life or even short term quality of life? And so in different cultures, that's meant burnout. It's meant languishing. It's meant, in some cases, crisis points like suicide. So we need to be more holistic and acknowledge.
Yeah.
So human sustainability is about that, creating an environment where we can meet our short-term and long-term needs in balance. And obviously there's going to be seasonality to that, and that should be mapped out against the standard performance cycles. Like, you know, a couple of months ago, we went through Q4, the end of our year, and it's always a pressure point. How we choose as an organisation to respond to that pressure point is really interesting and important.
Yeah.
Same might go as a relevant example for people at the moment, restructuring or layoffs. Mm. How do we as an organisation choose to, for those that have chosen to or are left behind, really embrace the sustainability agenda of that talent base? So I think that answers your question. I think there was a second part to it which I've forgotten, which maybe you can remind me of.
I will do, but I suppose even before I remind you of it, I'm aware that this conversation will be triggering to some listeners. We've discussed some stark realities. And I want to just take a moment, you know, to reflect on that and to say that there are many mental health challenges that we face. Some obviously quite extreme. Others, as you say, people are functioning, but they're functioning with a reduced quality of life, maybe with, you know, high anxiety, which sort of isn't abating, maybe, you know, in a state of depression, maybe in a state of burnout, but sort of keeping going. So we've definitely talked about some of the worst case outcomes, but I think we have to be aware that so many people are struggling in some degree. And what I think is really helpful about what you're doing, one of the things that we believe at the World Wellbeing Movement is we need to be able to quantify. We need to be able to look at root causes, because how can you solve for something if you don't understand A, how big is the issue, and B, what's causing the issue, what's driving the issue? And this is where I think your Human Sustainability Index comes in. It's helping quantify the challenge, but it's also helping identify the root causes of the challenge. Is that fair?
It is fair. And what's interesting, and I would definitely come on to HSI, because what you sparked when I was hearing you then is actually like a personal example, which I thought might be helpful just to throw in. So it was probably about 6 months ago, I lost a baby at 3 months, and it's a traumatic process. And obviously, you know, trying to grieve when you're working full time and trying to even have a moment with your partner where you're like, are you okay? What was really interesting, though, I'm trying to share that example because we've all got layers going on.
Yeah.
And in that scenario, I can be happy because we went through a lovely Christmas together, but also grieving underneath it. And what was interesting is I chose, while I was going through the physical process, to be very clear with everyone at Aon.
Mm.
And I noticed that actually there hadn't been that culture before. And sometimes it's met brilliantly in some cultures, sometimes it's hostility, but that is all part of our role, to start to be really honest that it's very, very human not to be okay. Even if you're not struggling, like these human experiences we need to acknowledge are real. And you can be at work, but you can still be having counter experiences. And I just wanted to kind of pause on that because I love where you tried to take, like acknowledging the conversation we're having. And also I think it's fun to say, chief well-being officers struggle too. Like this is very reasonable and normal to experience that.
And first of all, I want to thank you sincerely for sharing something that was also so recent. So it's obviously still going to be very difficult to talk about. So thank you. But it is so important. And what you have demonstrated with your vulnerability and authenticity is that you're a human being. Now, you lead the employee well-being remit for about 50,000 human beings. Is that right?
Yeah.
In about 120 different countries.
Spot on.
And what I think is really important to remember, and it can be difficult, you know, there's phrases that I'm averse to. One phrase I'm averse to is human resources. We're not resources, we're people. Each and every person is unique and is individual and is bringing a set of individual challenges to their work every day. Are you seeing differences in terms of the challenges that people are bringing at a geographical level? Because your 50,000 people are dispersed across 120 countries. Is that something you're seeing, or actually are some of the challenges quite universal?
So some are universal. I just wanted to acknowledge I have the most phenomenal trailblazing chief people officer, Lisa Stevens, who is enabling my role in many different ways. And that needs to be acknowledged because these things don't happen on their own. What we often talk about is the sort of almost the horizontal. So how do we create awareness and skills at the leadership level as well as the ecosystem? When you think about the ecosystem, the rest of our colleagues, there are obviously going to be cultural nuances, even thinking, stepping back and go, you have Confucianist mentality in Asia. So is it okay if I even speak to my parents about how I'm feeling? You then have, you know, us Brits, traditionally have brushed it under the carpet, but we've been lucky with campaigns like this, even the role of the royal family, where it's been brought to life and we are normalizing it, which is wonderful. You then have the US population, where it is about striving for your American dream and probably more individualistic in their thinking. So you do have to be sensitive to these cultural norms that sit behind that. Final example, which can be quite fun. I'm not saying these countries don't feel it, but go to Italy, go to Spain. This is part and parcel of their way of life. It's like, we don't need to teach them. They take 3 weeks holiday from the summer because that's their norm. And culturally, sustainability has always been how the society responds to life. And that's an overgeneralization, but you can see, hopefully it's painting a picture of really interesting different nuances. So you might have the same approach, but landing it in a relevant way for each culture is hugely important.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we can learn a lot as well from other cultures who understand how to enable well-being a little bit better. So whether that be, there's been a lot of media recently about the Blue Zone communities. And also the World Happiness Report shares a lot of insights from various different countries. So yes, I'm very happy to go and spend every August in Italy eating wonderful Italian food. Perhaps you'll come and join me. But going back,
Say maybe we can link it back to the Human Sustainability Index.
Great.
Because it's research based. It's with Bath University, but there's 8 pathways of how do you be sustainable in your life. And it's really interesting because there's your work, Blue Zone's work, general population of well-being. What do we even call ourselves? Because we're not advocates. We live and breathe this stuff. We're change makers. Yeah. Understand it. It doesn't sound logical, but most organizations have 3, 4, or 5 pillars, which are brilliant. So it's around mental health, physical health, financial health, and an element of social health.
Yeah.
What's really interesting, you're then missing things like meaning and purpose. You're missing things like, is there a difference between relationships and community? You're missing things like, well, actually, how do I be effective and competent in what we would frame as a smart or a hybrid world? Mm-hmm. And what happens if I choose to work this way, but my husband's fully virtual? How do we contract around that with a child if you choose to have a family, if you have a family? So what's really interesting is we can start to see the challenges by having that lens across different countries and curiously, we call it competence in action, that personal effectiveness piece and the mental health piece are the lowest scoring areas across. So what's interesting is, how do I actually design my day to be effective is a real challenge for a lot of people, especially when it comes to using technology appropriately, socially contracting with colleagues and friends and family. It's very, very new territory that none of us have been trained on. But this is all coming back to performance and sustainability. And what we can also start to see is, you know, slice and dice it by age, by gender, by tenure. Really interestingly, men focus on three pillars: physical health, mental health, and financial health. Women focus on all eight. So we're struggling to even balance. And men, if one of those legs, you know, really interesting with clients, the people you end up coaching are those that have a ski injury or an ankle injury or something where one pillar gets knocked and they don't have the robustness of the way they think about their sustainability through their relationships, through their own emotional health skill set, to then know how to pick themselves up. So we use HSI with clients, but internally, and we start to wrap that into our performance data. And
I'm going to point you, HSI is the tool.
You're so right.
I'm not a fan of TLAs, which are three-letter acronyms. but the Human Sustainability Index, sorry, please continue.
Perfect. So, if you think about it, it's not just a well-being lens, though.
Yeah.
So what happens if we choose to, this is all hypothetical examples, but choose to redesign our organization?
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting if we know the impact on sustainability pre and post? Isn't it also interesting if we have a change of leadership? What does that do, and how do we actually meet the needs of the organization when their needs shift in response to something like that? So actually, it might be very interesting that that individual has a clear competency against certain elements of their job, but they might need to think about meaning and purpose. How do they start to lens even into their communication side around the things that are being disrupted through change? So very simply, it's identifying how to be more human.
Yeah.
It's the human map. And we're really excited because we're kind of taking it to a place where we're linking in with board reporting, we're linking it into our extended leadership teams incentive models next year. So we're thinking about sustainable performance as the new measure of performance. And if that's on your KPIs, another three-letter acronym that you'd absolutely hate. But if it's on there, you lean into it. If you're paid to do that, paid to get this balance between sustainability and performance right, so really that's the change.
This is an interesting point. So what you're advocating for, C-suite execs, senior leaders, maybe even people managers, should all in their, whether it's a performance review or, you know, in their annual goals, they need to have a goal there around supporting the well-being of the people that report into them. Is that what you're saying?
I am. And I would also kind of caveat, we wouldn't call it that. We'd call it sustainable performance. So you'd think about what is the role of their own sustainable performance, and then what is their role with their team? And it is well-being, but it's separating it out. There is a direct link with performance. That's the kind of thing we really need to be clear on. And the role modeling piece is fascinating. So look at some of the stats coming out, the Deloitte research and others, like 78% of execs are struggling with their own sustainability. So if we don't have time to think about it, we don't have time to role model it, of course it's not going to happen beneath.
Yeah. And we had the co-founders of the 4-Day Week Global as previous guests, and they said that the most important people to really stick rigidly by a 4-day week if a company moves to that has got to be the senior leaders. Because if senior leaders are not walking the talk and they're not looking after their own well-being, that creates a cascade effect. But I want to talk, quite early in the conversation, you talked about managers, people managers. And of course, in some ways, people managers are maybe at that sort of middle level, and it's quite a big middle level. So you've got early stage people coming into the organization, and then, you know, they sort of initially become people managers. People managers really cascade culture, even in the best organizations in the world. If you're working for a manager who is perhaps cascading their stress or cascading an unmanageable workload, that's going to impact your well-being. But I also feel that managers get a bit of a bad rap because they're not given enough training, is the reality. So they've got this really important role, sometimes unwittingly, they may not quite realize that they're playing a role in people's well-being. They may think, you know, my job is to make sure that, you know, maybe you're an accountant. My job is to make sure that, you know, we submit all the tax returns for our clients on time. Actually, no, your job is to support your people. And as you say, there's that balance between well-being and performance. But what do you recommend to support managers to help them with that very complex and very difficult role?
Yeah, and it's interesting hearing you say that. It's like, oh gosh, I can put myself in the seat of a manager, which we've now shifted towards calling people leaders internally. Put myself in the seat of a people leader and I go, you're just telling me an and. This is just another thing on my to-do list. And it's a really interesting predicament. Mm-hmm. What we also hear when we speak to clients about it is, you know, people may have been promoted because of their subject matter expertise. So again, how do we start to train? So yes, we have a need for training because we think there's a capability gap. Also, what does that capability now mean in an AI environment? Oh, and by the way, can you help us completely transform that skill set? But you're not allowed more than 10 minutes a week. Da, 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 da. And this is the reality because of the tension point of it being potentially an and until you really recreate roles maybe dedicated to this or think about a slightly different model. So what we've done is just appreciate that that is the reality. We've got to be very, very pragmatic about it. And so we actually have a digital way of supporting people, but over an extended time. So we do take people through some people leader competency model assessments, mm-hmm. the Human Sustainability Index to layer in their own role modeling around sustainability. And then we nudge them literally 10 to 15 minutes a week for an extended period to say, in this scenario, how would you actually respond? Mm-hmm. And you receive coaching off the back of your response to say, well, actually, a more sustainable approach would have looked like or could have looked like this. Mm-hmm. So it's very informal, light touch, but it's that moment in the week. Like, what was that moment in the week where you thought differently, reflected on your own behavior? So rather than it feeling like a workshop where I'm going to go and alienate myself from my day job, transform and then come back to the reality of everything being the same, it's very much kind of threading it and weaving it in. So appreciate it's part of the journey, but we now invest that for all of our people leaders next year. And then we go deeper for new people leaders.
Yeah.
Because we also acknowledge that that is a subtly, you know, screener. It's we're probably areas where we need more handholding. And that's where we would end up providing more of that community coaching. How do you actually grapple with this situation? So brilliant. I love the sentiment behind what you're trying to tell us, but I'm under-resourced. How do I figure that one out? Mm-hmm. So again, it just feels like we're plugging well-being into the reality of the performance agenda rather than removing it and sidelining it, if that makes sense.
And it sounds to me like this is ongoing training. This is continuous learning. This is not, congratulations, you've been promoted to a people leader. Here's some training. Now off you go.
Yeah, you're spot on. And, you know, if we all step back and go, actually, our own well-being practice, it is a practice, isn't it? That's it. Like, we all have days where, even if we're adoring the well-being concept, where we're clearly not behaving like that. So I love this idea of it being iterative, which feels more human as well.
What about each and every employee? And there's a couple of aspects I'd like to talk about. One is, I'd love to hear what you're doing just to support each and every individual to thrive. But you also mentioned that sometimes people are promoted to a people leader roles because they might be a subject matter expert, but they might not be interested in becoming a people leader. Are there other avenues for individuals who say, I love my job, I'm enjoying it, but that's not a pathway I want to take?
Yeah, and I think just to pick up on that last one, I would say generally that probably isn't an example for Aon, but I do think just having that candor is really interesting. So most organizations in 2024 or thinking about it in 25 are reviewing their skills. So they think about how in 5 years time am I going to ensure that we have the right skills for our workforce? Mm-hmm. Like at the moment in the UK, there is a gap between what organizations will need and the reality of how we've trained our population. Mm-hmm. So there is also a cost to that. It's far easier to retain and retrain someone who's already in your system rather than to bring somebody else in. Sometimes I've heard 60, 80, 100% more cost effective to look after those that are already with you. So as you start to really think about that, it's all part of this conversation about new career paths. And there's some really interesting work going on there, as like, you know, almost using the analogy of are you 2 feet in? Are you 1 foot in, maybe at different career stages? And as a result, what do you have the capacity for, and how do we map that to our future skills? Yeah. And what's really interesting, and this is kind of a trivial example, I read somewhere if you're going to ask your three-year-old what careers should you be instilling in them that are guaranteed in an AI environment, it was quite fun. Obviously, a lot of it was digital and technology, and there was also a couple of things in there like yoga teacher, because we're all going to have mental health crises that we need to think about. Psychologists, you know, all of that good stuff. But there is that appreciation of the human skill set in the future skills thinking, which is really where we need to lean into organisations to help colleagues be really appreciative of, am I going to role model it and that's my bag, or am I going to manage people and coach them through their own role modelling?
Yeah.
So I think that's a really important thing to hold on to. The second part of your question, I think you have to remind me, I think it was about colleagues and how we support colleagues.
Yeah, so, I mean, we've talked a little bit about how you support managers, but I'm really interested in how you support individuals to thrive. So less the reactive ill-being supports, but more the well-being support structures that are in there. So maybe I give the example of somebody might join you out of, you know, university, perhaps as a new graduate. What's their experience going to be in those first couple of years?
Yeah. So the consistency we give everybody, so the 50,000 people, is access to what we think are best in class ill-being and well-being solutions. So think of it as traditional benefits, which obviously you can choose, but we try our very best globally to kind of talk in a health world about minimum standards. So we ensure that in certain countries, it's actually really hard to build a minimum standard. What a minimum standard means in a country with an NHS versus a country that doesn't have that type of even access to healthcare, it's a really interesting conversation when you're thinking about a global lens. But we also have global platforms that enable people to learn and develop, not simply at that plaster crisis point. So that's where we have education programs online. We also have access to classes. Different classes can also be along our spectrum of the human sustainability pathway. So it's not just a physical health provision. You can drop into emotional health conversations with a professional. Mm. You can think about how you create belonging. We also have training, particularly for certain roles.
Yes.
The other thing, though, I think we've done, so that was what I'd call, and it'll sound clumsy language, but it's the blanket. Like, what blanket do we want to offer people for everyone?
Yeah.
Then what we've done is look at the data and start to say, where are our risks, where we're going to white glove a little bit more?
Yeah.
And it might not be a well-being risk data point. It might be a retention or an attraction or even a succession. Why haven't we got people wanting to fill those roles in that particular part of our business?
Yeah.
Succession planning data I find fascinating. So what we've then chosen to do is initially in 2023 focus on two areas.
Mm-hmm.
One was onboarding, how we choose to onboard all colleagues.
Yeah.
Naturally, that's going to, for us, it's about 6,000, I think, early careers. And then 10,000 new joiners throughout the year. So think about that as when they join, they go through in the first 3 months an onboarding program, which includes the Human Sustainability Index, which is linked to all of their offerings around ill-being and well-being. And then every month for 12 months, you get access to community coaching because we really want you to build a sustainable life here. And then you redo the same assessment to see your improvement. And that's really interesting because often 12 to 18 months is a risk point for organisations. The other risk point we've found is, you know, it was a little bit hypothetical before we had the full data stories. Are we rewarding our high performers for burning out? Let's just ask ourselves. So we started to invest in layering in sustainability and well-being into our high performance agenda. And we're sort of going into, we're now in the throe of the second year of that and learning how best to do it. And that's where we do a subtly different thing. These are highly intelligent, highly ambitious people. So we need to do things like heart rate variability monitors, one-to-one coaching. We need to think about that, again, provocative ways to help them pause and stop and think about their own sustainability and also their teams. And then what I'm really excited about now in 2024 is we're scaling that type of thinking and realising, okay, have we given awareness for everybody. Mm. So the goal is that everybody globally would go through the Human Sustainability Index. We have certain, I call them breath points throughout the year. Whole business shuts for wellbeing days, 2 wellbeing days a year. What that means, though, is like if your inbox is left, you're not going on holiday and then your inbox comes back and it's full. Everybody in the whole ecosystem of Aon stops. Mm-hmm. And linking how we see those breath points to the human sustainability data as well is going to be really interesting. And then maybe going on from that, as we start to ritualize this sort of standard approach, we want to start to layer it into the way we think about our business.
Yeah.
So what if, as we're going through typically in most organizations, not necessarily if your year end is different, but maybe September, October, you're starting to plan about your growth objectives for next year.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to grow 5%, 10%, 15%? What investment do we need? What if you actually had the basis score of the sustainability of your team to be able to inform what capacity you actually had to deliver on your targets next year? How do you feel more reasonable with that? Mm. And also the investment case then is about sustainability of that growth plan,
yeah,
rather than another human resource to plug in and just enable it. Yeah. So that's where we've been. We are, and where we're trying to go to, if that's helpful.
It's hugely helpful. But as I listen to you, it just sounds like you have such a huge remit. You've got an awful lot on your shoulders. So in some ways, I'd like to turn the attention to you now. And I'd like to find out what you do to support your own well-being. One of the phrases that I like is a well-being non-negotiable. So one of the things I do with my team is I ask them, what are your well-being non-negotiables? And I've had answers like, one of my colleagues is a part-time yoga instructor as well. And, you know, she obviously, you know, some days does that. And if she's not online at 11 a.m, I know why. And that's absolutely perfect. One of my own well-being non-negotiables is making sure that I'm carving out time for myself to actually get some sunlight. That is more difficult during winter than it is during summer. So go for a short walk. Sometimes it's a longer walk. Sometimes it's a shorter walk. But we all have well-being non-negotiables. And I'd love to know what your personal well-being non-negotiables are.
What a great question. Thank you. And I was sort of having my husband humorously saying, you really think you can distill yours to one?
I want more. I think we should all have far more than one, please.
So very basically, and I was sort of kind of foundationally, my husband and I know exactly what our one negotiable is in terms of where we have to ask each other to cover. So Tuesday nights for me is a yin yoga class in the evening. And even like, my wonderful team know that, so there's no US calls, just get kicked out of the diary if I'm working. So that is it. Fortunately, the yoga studio is literally 3 minutes across the road, so I'm guaranteed to be there every week. My husband has a Thursday night tennis match, and so we just know. Those are the two things, the non-negotiables. Those are not trivial. Those are really important.
Yeah.
I think especially if you're in a caring position, how do you have that little bit of time to yourself is really important. However, what I was also observing, there's probably a few. Like, I also enjoy every Saturday I take my daughter swimming. That is such a buoyant cut end of week into something physical. Well, it's also standing in a cold swimming pool, shivering while she's so excited by her progress of drowning herself again. But there's something so nice, I think, about clear delineation of one part of your life to the next. It's always a Saturday morning first thing. And I feel like not necessarily a shift, but a letting go.
Mm-hmm.
Now, full-time mum, I am in the week, but it's more blended. I'm fully here for you. And for me, you know, everybody chooses to work in different ways. But at this stage of my life, it's a non-negotiable. I'm not going to work weekends. But the bigger thing that I've noticed that derails me,
yeah,
is when my understanding of my own meaning and purpose feels misaligned to what's going on. So I've noticed that usually once a month I have to journal and sort of say, like, I'm pretty strong with what my personal values are, and you know, they do evolve. The top three, maybe the five becomes the three, and they naturally start to sort of percolate through natural life changes. But if I've forgotten why I'm doing this, so as life happens, especially in the corporate world, things move and it kind of meanders, I have to hook it back to, why am I doing this? And am I clear that I'm heading the right direction, that also Lisa wants me to be heading? And again, to use my daughter Olivia's unicorn rainbow analogy, like the picture every quarter of the rainbow needs of Aeon changes.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether it's a change of leadership, recessionary environment, end of year-itis, how do I ensure that my original plan for those 3 months is actually what the business needs and what I feel is right for the broader thinking? And so I find that I need to do that work first. Mm-hmm. And how I am sustaining myself also needs to be part of that, because those three things are the tension point. And then I also need the feedback from Lisa to say, yes, I agree with you. So I find that kind of process really important, because this is only part of me. But it is taking, it does take a lot of energy of me.
And just checking in on that, because I think it's really great advice, actually, for us all to check in with, what is my purpose here? And I think there's a few things to this. So one dimension of well-being, Aristotle and philosophers and academics will talk about eudaimonic well-being. And eudaimonic well-being is feeling that you're living a meaningful life with purpose. And, you know, that can be difficult at different stages in your life. You know, I'm very, very well aware we are living through a cost of living crisis. So not everybody has the luxury of working in a role where they get that sense of purpose from, sadly. Some people are working just to make ends meet. But where at all possible, having just that moment to pause and think, how can I derive a sense of purpose from this? And actually, is there something else attainable that I might be able to derive a sense of purpose from, I think is really helpful. But it's also helpful if you've got a to-do list. So I'm a terrible one for having a lengthy to-do list. And I look at it and I feel overwhelmed, because I suffer from overwhelm, if that's an official diagnosis. And my way of coping with that is saying, right, what is the must-do list and what's the nice-to-do list? Because that should be a very different list. And maybe looking at the purpose, the goals, might help distill the must-do elements from the, if I got time, they'd be nice to do, but I could do them next week or next month.
I love that. And it's the classic sort of, when you're tired, ironically, you make strange decisions for yourself. Like, oh, well, I should do the nice to-do stuff because that might make myself feel better and I might be a better cop. And you're like, well, no, it's completely misaligned to the reality of how you can make the best impact. So this year, I'm now very, very clear that 50% in light of the world, 50% of my attention is on our colleague approach.
Mm-hmm. And as opposed to, because you have an external role as well.
I have an external role as well. Yeah. And often the two can kind of, you know, there's changes and evolutions of that. But this year, this is what's needed. So quite literally, I go to, right, 50% is 2.5 days. Mm-hmm. So quite literally, how do I let things go on one side of my role to enable that? And what's my best way that I can actually be there in the organization? So even things like, we have a global employee assistance program, and we think about it as individual, team and organizational well-being. Their collateral of webinars, or their sort of schedule of webinars, are 100% focused on individual well-being. So there's a big gap in the team well-being.
Right.
So for me, well, great, there's a gap. That's on us, because we have a different way of thinking about this than the rest of the market, which is, we think is quite mature. So I'm going to dedicate time to create that.
Yeah.
So it's simple things like that, because we're pushing the boundaries, but also being very candid with the team as well, saying, is this what we want to be prioritizing the well-being time for our organization? And also, isn't it interesting, if you have that 2.5 days, what if there is a sudden moment with each region to say, how is the team well-being embedding? Would you like some more time? Would you like some more sessions to help that really trickle in beyond the digital approach? And that's really what I love about the kind of analogy of, you launch stuff, then you need to embed it.
Yeah.
And so I'm really grateful that that kind of 50% of my role is all about the embedding of the tougher stuff this year, but in a good way, in a really exciting way too.
And so as I understand that, 50% of your role is focusing on the, I'm still going to call it well-being, on the well-being of those 50,000 employees across 120 countries, each of whom is unique and each of whom is individual.
Yeah.
So you've given me some fascinating insights, but I would love to go to what I call the rapid fire round.
Let's do it.
So, if you had a time machine, a DeLorean, and you could travel 30 years into the future, what is the change that you would like to see in the world?
Every organisation on the FTSE 100 or wherever the S&P or whichever framework you want to look at is measured and valued based on their sustainable performance.
I love that. And well-being is a key component
is everything.
Of the sustainable performance. Right. I want you to hop back in your DeLorean and I want you to travel back in time and I want you to meet with your 18-year-old self. What advice would you give that young woman?
Well, when I was 18, I had my first grey hair. So my advice would be, don't worry, you can dye your hair and no one will notice. But aside from that, trust that you're always in the right place at the right time.
Trust that the universe has your back?
Completely.
Amazing. So, what's the best advice you've ever received?
It's a really hard question. I receive a lot of advice, some of it not wanted, but I have two things going on in my head, almost the feminine and the masculine. So I have two phenomenal role model parents who are still highly influential in my life, but collectively they help me understand the full HSI spectrum. And their wisdom has always been, at each life stage, appreciate that the balance will come if you gain full awareness of those ingredients. So even if you feel like you're not there yet, sometimes allowing and committing to it and trusting that it will come, it often ends up happening in a very cyclical way.
And that's probably advice that's easier to agree with in hindsight as you look back on previous chapters of your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what do you wish you'd learned sooner?
I wish I'd learned sooner that work can be really fun.
That's a nice one. I think that's a really important one to reflect on, actually, because we can all get caught up in stress, deadlines, assignments, maybe even financial concerns, concerns about job security, because we are living in an environment where, very sadly, there have been a lot of layoffs in the past year. But take a moment to live in the present and to find the fun and find fun with your colleagues and laugh. I like that one. I'm going to ask you one final question. What do you think is the secret to a good life?
Where my heart went was designing a sustainable life with your team. And I mean, my husband is my teammate and he is making different decisions to enable me to do this type of work. Olivia is also part of that. Our parents are also part of that, as we're quite different role models in our friendship group, the way we've chosen to design things, and also with our colleagues and friends. It's really interesting, but I think that choice around sustainability, my complete gratitude to my husband especially, that's what it's all about.
It really is. And what's your husband's name?
Rob.
Rob. Well, thank you, Rob. And I'd also like to thank my husband, Alan, who is also
the
most
in the
incredible
pub together
rock.
At the moment, aren't they?
Knocking back the Guinnesses. But I couldn't agree more. I think we all need to be very aware of the support structures that we have and have that gratitude. So what a perfect place to end a fascinating interview. Thank you so much, Rachel.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And I couldn't agree the best place to end.